The thing I like about this music is that it says things are bad and there's no period. It just trails off or it smashes into the next song. And there is something so affirming in that expression.
That's real.
Welcome to This Is Your Afterlife. I'm Dave Marr. I am a comedian who survived a coma, and on this show, I talk to artists and organizers about death, art, politics, and the events that define our lives. I'm back. The show has been gone for over a year, just over a year, but over a year, and now it is back. I have a bunch of great episodes I'm excited to bring to your ears. Welcome to new listeners. Welcome back to old listeners. Thank you for sticking in there or just now sinking your claws in. I want to bring you this guest because she has been a big part of this year away that I have had. At the end of the released episodes last year, I started talking about this book, Black Metal Rainbows, and how it was getting me into the genre of music known as black metal. I discovered her music, the music of Genital Shame, the her being Erin Dawson, and then we became friends, starting really in a lot of ways with this episode. After this episode was recorded, I brought Erin on board as my sort of the Kevin Eubanks to my Jay Leno in this black metal talk show I did in July of this year called Black Metal Patio, which was a rework of a performance art installation I did called Black Metal Rooftop. There's a little bit more about that in the show description and in this episode. So I thought this would be a perfect first episode back. So thank you so much for listening. I don't run ads on the show. I support the show financially, which, you know, it does incur financial costs through Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/thisisyourafterlife. Note that that is a new URL. So I won't even say the old URL. I was tempted to. I won't. But for $5 a month, you get the premium feed with bonus episodes on the off weeks. That is one change to make this more sustainable for myself. These episodes on the main feed here are going to come out every other week, but you can still get weekly episodes of This Is Your Afterlife by going to patreon.com/thisisyourafterlife. Join in for $5 a month. You get the premium feed, which includes these episodes plus the bonus episodes on the off weeks. For $15 a month on the Patreon, you become a posthumous producer. This is a thing I'm trying out. I used to call these pigeon-level patrons. That was a reference to one of my live shows that may be too deep a reference at this point. So I'm calling these people posthumous producers, and you get thanked every episode. So thank you to those people, Katie Llewellyn, Fred Fidawa, Shubha Singh, G, and Debo. We are back, folks. That is the business I have for the top of the show. Please enjoy this fantastic conversation I have with Erin Dawson, also known as Genital Shame. I'm hoping if it's not too rudimentary, we can do some like black metal 101.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure.
Including for me. So while I was preparing this performance art piece that included a black metal soundtrack, very late in the process, mostly I've listened to this stuff in my car. I attempted to, you know, scream, sing along with what I was listening to. And it felt so embarrassing. By myself in the car in a way I did not expect. I was like, I don't know how. I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you do it while not shredding your voice. And these are questions that I imagine like to a new person must come up all the time. But they're genuine questions as a new black metal fan that I have.
Yeah.
So let me take them one by one. What is the point of writing lyrics as a black metal artist?
Is this the podcast?
Yeah. Well, it might end up being, but this okay. part is at least like for me to know.
I just want to know if we've started or not.
Yeah. This very likely could end up in the podcast, but I especially am just like curious as a getting to know you and for my own, you know, true cult education.
Dope. Yes. It's so forgive me. The question again is, what is the point of writing black metal lyrics?
We'll start there. So
yeah.
Like, why write lyrics? There's plenty of music I like pop music where I don't understand the lyrics, but for some reason it feels more important here, especially because a lot of the cones you have to drive through and around to enjoy this music without accidentally endorsing fascism require knowledge of the lyrics. Why, what's the importance of lyrics as you're making the music?
I'll take this in two ways. First, I'll start out with, I think, why lyrics are a lever for advancing black metal thought for a lot of folks, including the progenitors of that. But I'll also talk about my approach to it, which is very different. Put really reductively, and I am not a scholar on this stuff, I'm hardly educated about it. To my best understanding, black metal, not just sonically, but as an ethos, is about the embrace of power through nature, becoming, defiance, the resistance of enforced morality, and a symbolic way to do that, in a political and historical way to do that, is to do that as a reaction to the growing influence of Christendom in Scandinavia in the late 80s, early 90s, this kind of thing. And lyrics function as a poetic way to do that. And part of that was to give a rude hand gesture to Christianity, of course. And I looked this up somewhat recently myself, which is, to what extent is the embrace of the occult, of Satanism, by those early folks, those like second wave black metal folks, to what extent was that a truly held belief? And to what extent was that imagery used as a, I don't necessarily believe in the Satan, as a real being that exists tangibly or intangibly. I don't believe in it, but I will use it to troll Christians.
Right.
You know, and there is a mix. There is a mix of both. Gorgoroth, you know, this is a band that dude really believes in the Ha-Satan, in Lucifer, whereas others are like, you know, Dark Throne, I think being one of them, is like Satan, lol. You know what I mean? Which I love. I love both, but the second one more, I think, because it aligns with my belief, which is I'm a materialist, basically. So that's black metal thought, and that's black metal lyrics traditionally held, at least for the second wave.
Yes.
For me, to the extent that Genital Shame is a black metal band, and, you know, of course, this is me getting ahead of this, right? Which is like, Genital Shame is not a black metal band outright.
The need to like...
I know, right?
Any culture or subculture you're a part of where you need to clarify your distance from the true platonic ideal of the thing is just, it's an exhausting project, but please go ahead.
It's exhausting. However, I like keeping gates, I have to admit. And so I kind of get it.
Okay. There are certain gates I like to keep, but then 1,000%. Other gates that I believe shouldn't be kept are the one, you know what I mean? And it's hard to align with people 100% on that.
They need to be kept in like a master lock with an easily guessable 4-figure pin. So that's the gate that I want to just like leave wide open, which is to say, like, look, you know, Genital Shame is not a traditional black metal band. One bit that I like is the idea of, like, you go to a restaurant and you see blackened tilapia or like blackened cod or whatever.
Yeah.
This is blackened whatever it is.
Mm-hmm,
it's blackened.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Back to lyrics, though. My approach to lyrics in general, Shame, is 1,000,000,000% different than the traditional take on lyrics. It's honestly a borrowing of emo music. And I mean, I love confessional writing. I love confessional film and podcasts, right? Like, and I was an emo kid. I was a metal kid, of course, but secondarily, I was definitely an emo kid. And the biographical nature of what a lot of emo does, or and a lot of indie music, resonates with me because it resonates with the human experience. I don't believe in Hasatan. I don't believe in Jesus Christ. But I do know what going through a breakup's like, and I do know what struggling with your identity is like, et cetera, et cetera. So write what you know. I know those things. So yeah, that's my approach to lyrics.
And then the, you know what I'm even more curious about is the relationship of the lyrics to their unintelligibility as screamed. So it's like, so when I say why, it's like, have you been on any of these tour dates and been like, oh, I forget the exact phrase here, but I know that I scream about this length of time and kind of in this register. And so I'll do that.
Almost every night.
Okay.
I mean, it's about 10% of the time or less. There are certain passages where I'm like, you know what? What's not important here is I don't know if the lyric is cricket or croquet.
Right.
But I know it's two syllables.
Yeah.
And I know that I mean it. So I'm going to put my back into it.
Sure. Totally. I guess that's what's really fascinating is the lyrics are clearly so important. And yet they are almost universally impossible to tell from listening to the music.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Put that way, maybe this is where I should just like do the 12 monkeys in a room, but with ChatGPT, if no one really knows.
But I think it's not, I mean, that's the hard thing is how to ask the question without suggesting they're.
No,
the last thing is that I know, and I know you know that I'm not doing that.
Whoa, but metacognition.
Yeah, but it because it feels important that both of those things are true at the same time.
Yes, I think lyric writing alongside music writing is an almost equally important form of expression, even if you know in your body when you hear 16th notes and you don't know in your brain if I'm saying cricket or croquet.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, as an artist, TM, it is important to channel as a form of songwriting what I want to do with the song by way of language, at least for me. And I think the idea that people on tour were like, hey, what are those lyrics? Why aren't they on Bandcamp? Tells me that at least a few people in the world can hear the emotion or passion or whatever with which I'm screaming my head off and have a sense from the song title or whatever words that are intelligible that there is a message here and that it's probably important to understand the song fully. So yeah, maybe lyrics are actually a huge part of this.
This is related to I think one of the first things when I DM'd you was that I loved the titles and consider myself sort of a title guy. Like, you know, you could, in middle school, having like just notebooks full of band names that never produced any music. And
can you remember some of them?
Yeah. So the one that I thought was like just so brilliant was was somebody ran over an elephant. So I thought that was really great. And then
what kind of music do they play?
Oh, well, it definitely played like post Supertones, post Five Iron Frenzy. What would it be at that point? Like third wave ska,
is
pop punk sort of situation.
What was the Five Iron Frenzy? Is that band?
Yeah.
Is that like a military wife band? Like Five Finger Death Punch? Maybe I'm confusing them.
Is the title Military Wife? Is that what you're asking? Or did they all...
I'm categorizing Five Finger Death Punch as military wife music.
Subgenre
of butt rock.
No, I would call Five Iron Frenzy like youth group music.
Oh, okay.
Like cool kid at youth group.
A lot of delay pedals in that.
Yeah, yeah. But ska, like very okay. Ska. And the other one that's probably more like just purely embarrassing was, I mean, this is all coming from like an evangelical damaged background. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But Chosen with a Z.
Bro.
Okay. Which I think ended up being, I think there was a short-lived Danny McBride cartoon that had the band's name, or I think he was a rapper, maybe named Chosen with a, he was a Christian rapper. So like,
yeah.
Yeah. When I included a link to the Juliana theory in my email, that was a hard one link. And I was surprised to hear you reference them in another interview.
So funny. That definitely put a smile on my face.
Are we coming from similar backgrounds there?
In multiple ways. I think the evangelical one being one of them.
Yeah.
But I think musically too.
That
I don't
was
know what,
your flavor of Christianity though that you sort of grew up with?
Church of Christ was the flavor.
Okay. Sure.
So for folks who don't know what that means, and I'm assuming we have started, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. For folks who don't know and may be interested, and if you're not, I'm sorry, I'll make this quick. Church of Christ is a sect or flavor of Christianity that is pretty very much conservative. Theologically, they're one of those ones that's like you could be in the car on your way to get baptized and get T-bone pass away and like, oh, brother, I'm so sorry. You can't get into heaven. Mm-hmm. And, you know, women aren't, you know, a part of the picture in a meaningful way. No dancing, usually. No instruments. They look at the Book of Acts as the first church and the most accurate version of the Christian church. And so does whatever Acts says to do and does not say anything that Acts and other parts of the Bible are silent about. But for me, I was able to listen to music that was outside of Christian rock, though Christian rock was a big part of, you know, my diet as well. Sounds like you too.
Not until much later. It took the Supertones and MXPX were both on a compilation that then, fortunately, my curiosity was great enough that I was like, where does this come from? Like,
and
the sort of like early internet web pages documenting like trees of like going back to Jamaican ska and stuff. Like,
wild.
I like ate
okay,
that
yeah.
stuff up. But speaking in tongues at Church of Christ, was that a?
No.
Okay.
No. I don't think so, and at least not the churches that I went to. What was your flavor growing up?
It was
Dave?
More of the like DIY, non-denominational as a denomination. You know what I mean? Definitely speaking in tongues, but
Whoa.
It also kind of like changed with. By the time we moved to, when I was in eighth grade, we moved to Cincinnati and my parents ended up in an Assembly of God church. And so that fit with like where we were and they did speaking in tongues. But before that, it was just like, we're evangelical. We believe in spreading the word. We believe in, you know, and
the Great Commish.
Yes, and rock music for sure in the church, you know.
Whoa.
So like the bands, like my brother is like a great drummer and came up like playing in little garage punk bands, but also at, you know, at church and stuff.
Church.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a cartoon on HBO made in the 2000s called The Life and Times of Tim.
Okay.
I don't know if you know it. It's not.
Yeah, the title's familiar.
Yeah, there's been a revival of it, but due to IP, they couldn't reprise it. So it's like The Life of Tom or something now, as of last year.
Okay.
It's all by the same guy. The story there is that like he's the dude who invented the WhatsApp and Budweiser frogs.
Okay.
And just got a goose egg and just always wanted to be an animator. Anyways, in the first iteration of this cartoon, Bob Saget is a guest who plays this gambling addict who wants to go to Sin City and wants to bring the main character with him. I promise I'm going somewhere with this. And he calls Cincinnati Sin City.
Yeah.
And I think that is very funny. And sometimes when I try to adopt that as a bit by myself, whatever the opposite of crushes, it grows.
Bombs. Like,
it never kills. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
Growing up there, did anyone ever refer to Cincinnati as Sin City?
I've heard it from people before. I think my recoil from it,
yeah,
is from kind of anyone wanting to. Most city names are rough, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I'm in Cleveland now, and am aware that if I were to start calling it the land, that people would hate it. But I kind of love that. But I think that must be because I only came here recently. Because I
has
came
that been
from,
coined? Do yeah. people say the land?
It's usually in like on billboards for like the Cavs and the Browns and like the sports teams.
You do in the subreddit, the land, probably. You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But if someone were to say Chi-Town, I'd be like, ugh, shudder. You know what I mean? And so I think it's like that there's a broiness to an abbreviation of a city name. But I do think I never really thought of it as like someone goofy enough to think that Cincinnati is Vegas. And that I do like. But then you're having to explain the bit as you're going and it's tough.
That is exactly why it's funny.
Yeah. No, yeah. I get that. I just would not have had the context for that.
Sure, of course. Yeah. I did a really bad job of explaining it. You're right, Dave. I'm sorry.
No. You did a great job of explaining it to me. You haven't been explaining it to the people.
I haven't.
You've been dropping it for. Yeah.
No, I haven't.
But the titles thing, the reason I brought up the titles thing is because I feel I love a title. This performance art piece that I did was called Black Metal Rooftop because it was a reference to Heavy Metal Parking Lot, that like 15-minute documentary.
That's so good.
And yes. I thought that was fucking brilliant, right? And
it
no
is.
One has that reference, right? It's like, and that's not even the most Heavy Metal Parking Lot was a little bit of a phenomenon, you know what I mean? But
at this point,
I'm old, you know, no Gen Zers have Heavy Metal Parking Lot as a reference.
They do not.
Black Metal Rooftop is it's like, but something about a title inspires me. And you said when we chatted that sometimes a title will come first for you.
Yeah.
And so I have guilt around that because, and I think I can weave this. Because growing up in that evangelical art framework where it was like message first, like that's how you get all this awful art that doesn't matter because they're saying Jesus 50 times in the song, you know? So now when I will go to create something and work top down, I feel guilty as if I'm not truly harvesting my life and just finding the connections. I'm like trying to force connections or force a message or like force a paradigm that I'm then getting out. Plus, coming from stand-up, it's like, oh, well, man, you just go up there, you write on stage, and then in a couple of years, you have an hour. And it's like the idea that I would be like, oh, actually, I'm like really angry that everyone's forgotten about COVID and Palestine has become completely like, and so I want to do like a piece about that. But then also the title like refers to heavy metal parking lot, but no one can like figure that out, is like, it's off-putting to like try in that way. This might all be me, but does any of that resonate for you? The guilt of like working top down in that way?
Man, I have so much to say about this. Guilt is my primary performance characteristic. But I don't have it for this very particular thing. But I want to say something first. And I think thinking in and through titles is profound. I love it so much. You do too. I think that's great. But I have something to say first, which is, you and I don't know each other that well, but what I'm going to guess is that level of self-reflection and analysis betrays that you have not just been in therapy, but done a lot of work in therapy. Is that not true?
Well, way more in terms of productive work, recovery stuff.
Yeah.
I've definitely been in a lot of therapy. Need to get back to like individual therapy, but in terms of, you know, the rooms, the capital P program.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, constantly.
I guess that, and I say that because, I mean, it chimes with my experience a lot, which I arrived at through therapy, which is to say that the guilt, the message first thing, it is a root system that affects everything, including things that are counterintuitive, which I think a lot of us balkanize the creative process as definitely a part of our identity, but we are creative because it is a refuge from systems like this or from guilt or whatever. But what you've just said is that like nothing is safe from this framework that you're taught at a super young age, not even titles. And the infinitesimal part of your life, which is like, what do I name this track on my stand-up special or whatever, being affected by being yelled at about hell or whatever is profound.
Yeah.
I think. And I think maybe thinking titles first and working backwards, finding the message afterwards, is a refutation and rude hand gesture to that super systemized way of process. So that rules, number one.
So you're saying,
yeah,
when you start with a title and it's an oppositional title, you can ensure that you're staying on message, which is like, fuck this root system, fuck my upbringing. Is that what you're saying?
That is a smarter way to say what I'm saying. Okay. What I'm simply saying is that by working what we're calling backwards is itself a refutation of that message first framework that you're talking about. It's a counterintuitive thing in the same way, but effective and true thing in the same way that the idea of queer joy is resistance is a counterintuitive idea, but a true one as well, which is to say like, oh my God, this thing that I never thought would be kind of a political, not political, but like a, you know, a self-healing and act of resistance, because it's so small, is that act of resistance. But also it's a great creative tool. So I'll talk about titles as they, you know, concern genital shame. There's a song on the upcoming record, which just got mastered. It's not out. Obviously, it's not released. It's not announced. Nothing like that. So probably next year. I don't know. But I really like these two words together. Spiced, one word. Loam, L-O-A-M.
Okay.
I really liked the image of seasoning dirt. And it's like one of my favorite songs on the record. It became a song about eating dirt. You know?
Yeah.
it's not an optimistic track, but it started with those two words together. It unlocked some sort of, you know, vault of image for me. I think working backwards in that way is just such an effective, profound way for me to work, at least. Yeah.
What do you hope happens when you die?
Oh, see, I'm already fucking up because what I remember the question is being, what do you think happens? What do you hope happens is a completely different.
I know.
So
pride doth goeth before the fall.
I'm falling out. I'm going to invoke, and I would be really surprised if no one has brought this up on your podcast, which I have listened to, and which is why I noticed the.
I know. It was a level of being seen that I was uncomfortable with because the guilt and shame is, oh, I moved to Cleveland and this thing is still active in my, I'm like, this is a thing I'm actively doing. And the feed would say, nope, you're sure not.
Right. The John Cena, are you sure about that? I'm also, while I'm talking and while I'm referencing a meme, I'm also doing that Taizan Day thing. Which is moving away from the mic to breathe, or when I laugh.
That is amazing. Yeah.
I just noticed that I've been doing that this whole time.
I didn't notice, but don't do that. Breathe and laugh, please.
Okay. I'm gonna try to do.
Yeah.
What I hope happens. So anyways, as I was saying, I'd be surprised if no one has brought this up on your podcast before, but invoking the Radiohead videotape idea.
No one has.
Do you know about this? Okay.
No. I know the song.
Yeah. I don't know what it's officially about. What I take it to mean, or what I remember thinking about as I've listened to it for whatever, 15 years, is the idea that in an afterlife, he talks about Mephistopheles and this kind of thing. So I think I can assume that it's set in an afterlife, that you are able to use a videotape to, and a sort of eternal recurrence framework, watch what you'd like to watch and experience over again what you'd like to experience over again. In terms of what I hope happens, it's a version of that, which, as I'm saying it, is quite bleak if there are no bounds, if there are no rules, and the afterlife can be like a Steve Martin joke, which is like a month of, or a lifetime, or an eon of masturbation and pure merciless blasts of dopamine and coming or whatever. And I'm like, I want to watch the time that I played a recital or kissed someone. That's, and live in the past. That's not great, I don't think. Canary in my coal mine is not thriving, maybe.
Well, imagining that, what if you, let's, I'd like you to like flesh out the physical circumstances of this, where so you've got the videotape and the tape is confined to moments from your life. Is that correct?
Yeah.
From your point of view, or do you also get the point of view of others?
In my mind, maybe because I'm defaulting to the, I know how this sounds, Nietzschean eternal recurrence thing, which I bet has absolutely been brought up on your podcast.
I don't think so. Nietzschean eternal recurrence. You're the first black metal artist.
Okay, just very, very, very quickly, as I understand it, again, not a scholar, I don't know what I'm talking about, but I think Nietzsche thought about this in two ways. It's this idea of eternal recurrence. One is it's a moral imperative or an idea for you to treat people with kindness or whatever, which is in the circumstance that the afterlife is you watching everything that you've done, I think from your perspective, over and over and over again, all 83 years of it, over and over and over again. Could you live with yourself? And if you can't, based on the past that you've had, maybe you should change the way that you are and be nicer to yourself and this kind of thing. So he believed it in that way. But as a second, as a corollary to that, I think he also literally believed that this is what the afterlife is. Mm. And I see videotape as a sort of extension of that idea. That's all.
And, okay, where, to be basic, like, where mm-hmm. are you as you're watching the videotape? Are you with anyone else? Is it a darkened room? Is it you're almost a disembodied consciousness?
I think this is where the thought experiment gets speculative and creepy. Speculative and creepy, which is what my shit absolutely, which, you know, it's a watchmaker argument for the afterlife. Like, who set up the VCR or whatever, Blu-ray, IMAX? Like, who did that? Who's putting you there? Who's doing this to us? I really like that idea. I don't have an answer for that. Yeah. But I think in my mind, it is a divine being, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
But are you with, do you get to You're be alone. With other people?
Okay. You're alone. Yeah. Okay. It's a cover of I Saw the TV Glow kind of vibe, which is like this emanating screen mm-hmm. and you are there and mm-hmm. That's it.
You saw I Saw the TV Glow?
I did, yeah.
Did you like it?
I did.
Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah, and I think I only saw it like a couple weeks or a month ago. Mm. And so I was kind of unaware of hype cycle and backlash and all that stuff. So,
yeah.
And I did not particularly like World's Fair.
Oh, no?
Yeah. I was like, okay, kind of. So, okay. Some of these, I respect them, you know.
It was my shit. For sure.
Yeah. Sure.
Okay. Yeah.
But, man,
but it's divisive. Yeah.
I saw the TV Glow, completely mm-hmm. rocked my shit. I was like,
hell
this
yeah.
is like, yeah.
Yeah,
I don't have anything interesting to say.
The soundtrack is brilliant too. Like that King Woman song, Jesus Christ.
The Maria BC is on there, I think, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm, I mm-hmm, love her. I
so. Yeah. Is she the one doing the Broken Social Scene cover?
No. Wait. Is there a new Broken Social Scene cover that's also No. I know what you're saying. Yes. That she's not. I don't
okay.
think.
Anyways, yeah.
Who is she? Yeah, I gotta figure it out. But anyway, we covered it. We got your hope. What would you know, the immediate thought that came to your mind in terms of what you think, I'll allow you to answer that too. I feel like I know the answer to that.
Oh, you do know the answer. And you know, I spoiled it earlier by saying that I'm basically right. a materialist. So the worm food idea is what I believe happens. Yeah.
And so now you can see why I ask the hope rather than
I'm
think.
Really in real time understanding. Yes.
One leads to a much meatier podcast yeah. than the other.
Truly. Yeah. Yeah. I get it now. You're a pro.
I'll go immediately then into the question I sent you that is most similar to your hope for the afterlife, which is the prompt to relive one memory,
yeah.
Where assuming an afterlife consists of you, as if it were a room, you choosing one memory from your life that you get to fully drop down into and relive whenever you want, however many times you want. Rest of your memories aren't wiped, but this is like the vivid one you get. But you have to choose one. Which memory do you choose?
When I saw the message, when I saw your email with these questions, I thought of two, and they both are pretty bleak memories, actually, that involve breakups or that precede the dissolution of a relationship, but were nevertheless very sweet. So I'm only picking one. So it is the chronologically the first one. Should I just paint this Paint a picture with words?
Yeah, yeah.
Is this the part where I do that? Okay, sick. The year was 2007, which is, I think, the best year in the last, in, of my lifetime.
Why?
For reasons I'll get into.
Okay.
Completely personal, interpersonal reasons, intellectual reasons, life experience reasons. But like, Obama was months away after Bush. I mean, we didn't know it, Donald Rumsfeld, the unknown unknowns. We didn't know.
Right.
But what we knew was...
The promise of Obama was surely very different than, yeah.
Truly. Anyways, so we can get to that later. Yeah. 2007, it was my end of my first year as a music student at this university. And I started dating Molly. Molly and I were still friends. I was living with my sister. And I walked home with my Alvarez... This guitar, it's a Alvarez Yari nylon string. I walked home after.
A different version of that, or the exact guitar that you just held up?
The same model as that. I eventually sold that guitar. Okay. I sold all my gear at one point. I don't know. Maybe you've done something similar. I've heard about this for like, if you go to school for like a artistic thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's not uncommon to like graduate and be like, I am done. Goodbye. I did a version of that. But look at me now. I'm on a podcast.
Yeah.
It's the twilight of the day. And there's a golden crisp apple in the sky. And I'm walking home and I'm texting on my Razor, my Motorola, to Molly. Would you like me to pick something up for us? I know you're meeting me at the apartment. She says, yes. What do I get? I get two hot and readies from Little Caesar on my way home. So on one arm, I'm cradling two hot and readies. And on the other, my guitar case. And I walk down the hill again. The sun is golden.
What toppings?
I think one cheese, one pep.
Okay.
To be honest.
Uh-huh.
And my sister and her and my soon-to-be brother-in-law, I'm living with my sister at the time, are in the kitchen. And we were in college, so we had lawn furniture as part of our living room set. And they're watching Stella or something with that one guy in it. Not Mike Liam Black, but the other guy.
Showalter, David Wayne?
Showalter, although I love a David Wayne. And Molly's hanging out with them there in the living room. And it's always a special thing when the person you're dating is... kind of forced to casually hang out with your family. They all liked each other. It was fine. But I got there and the merriment, whenever you show up with pizza, people traditionally love that.
Yeah.
You become pretty popular.
Yeah.
But we were hungry. So I sat my guitar case down and the apartment where we lived in had a hill in the back. So there's a little back porch and then a smooth little hill. So because it was so nice, Molly and I took the pizza outside with some plates and we ate pizza as the sun was going down. And that's not why this is my favorite memory. The reason that this is a favorite memory is because after eating this pizza, we kissed or something. We just like were affectionate with each other in a real way that was unmediated. We were so connected. And that connection overflowed, I think, into a part of our brain where we wanted to have fun in like a little kid way, not like in a bad boy way, like a Puff Daddy way.
Yeah.
And what we ended up doing is like just rolling down the hill like little kids with our bellies full of pizza as the sun was going down, you know? And she eventually drove away in her Mitsubishi Lancer. But like, it was wholesome. There was pizza involved. And it was during a time in my life where I was experiencing this renaissance of identity and intellect, which is what college was for me. I was a really bad student in like middle school and high school. Like, not good. And when I got to college, my frontal lobes just like came online. And I was a different person, and that is because I wasn't part of a church anymore.
Yeah,
as I come to know later, much later in life. But due to that renaissance and that day, it just like, I don't know, I think about it all the time. And this is where it gets bleak, which is like, I don't know how else to put this. This sounds dramatic. I don't mean it to be, but life since then, talk about hills. It's not been uphill, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's
sure.
like really easy for me to go back to that place where I don't even think innocence was part of it. I think I was fulfilled intellectually, musically, artistically, relationship-ally, community-wise. I was establishing community, finding my people. There was vitality that I don't know if you're anything like this, but like it's difficult to capture that after college, you know, and you read all the time about like, it's so hard to find adult relationships.
Yeah.
And it is.
For a reason. Yeah.
For so many reasons. But I had the lack of that. I did not have a problem with that. I, if anything, you know, I was making too many friends. Like it was just, it was the high point, I gotta say. So I think about that. I think about it a lot and measure things against it a lot. So I'll shut up, but that's it.
I mean, the podcast kind of depends on you not shutting
up. Oh, yeah. I forgot.
But it's so funny that you said it relates to a breakup.
Yeah.
Because if you hadn't told me that, it doesn't really relate to a breakup. It only if you see breakups as sort of a zero-sum game of like, if a relationship ends, the relationship was completely not worthwhile, which I would assume having been in therapy, you don't have that point of view.
This is a great example of cognitive dissonance. Talk about therapy speak.
Okay.
Which is, I know intellectually that is not the point of relationships.
Right.
That we learn something from every relationship, at least something. We learn many things. And for that reason alone, a breakup does not mean failure. This is a like Dan Savage-ism that I really like. So I intellectually believe that, but binary thinking,
yeah,
heaven or hell,
yes,
attendance or non-attendance, it's easy for me to be like, yeah, that was a breakup memory. That wasn't like a present memory. That wasn't I had a great day memory. It was a failure of a relationship. And therefore that gives a certain hue to that memory,
yeah,
which is not helpful, I guess.
I think, and tell me if I'm, you know, being too bold in my assessment of you, but I think some of your black and white is coming out in the casting of either hopeful or not hopeful. Everything is either like because spiced loam,
yeah,
eating dirt does not on its face absolutely imply something horrible to me. Eating
dirt
there's vitality in that. There is beauty. There's connection to earth. You know what I mean? And so I'm sensing a little bit of, again, tell me if it's projection, but self-loathing in the you know, everything is a grim or a hopeless memory if it has any tinge of negativity to it.
God, yeah.
Okay.
Couple things there. This is a really cliche and very corny idea, or its delivery was corny, but there's profundity to it, which is, God, I hate myself, and not just because you introduced self-loathing into
right,
the chat,
right, right,
but because I'm about to quote the Office, right? Which is that Ed Helms line that ends the series, basically, which is like, I'm going to get it wrong, but the idea is like, I wish you can know that you were in the good old days while you were living them, you know, and that, God, it sucks, but it's so corny, whatever, but it is really real.
Did you have that in that memory though? Okay.
Yeah. No, I think in that moment I was probably worried about, biology homework that I had to do,
sure,
you know, you're always fighting the last war, but you're also fighting like the next thing that you have to do. You can't. Yeah. I cannot be present. I've started a meditation practice in the last year, and it's been somewhat helpful. But I think, and this is the least important part of what you just said, because a lot of what you said was very good. But the
probably most of what I said was probably pretty important.
Yeah.
But let me pretty equally important.
Let me litigate the idea that eating dirt is beautiful.
Yeah.
I think, you know, those two words together inspiring this, like, the record is called Suicide is in the title. So it's that kind of a record. But I think the idea,
I mean, you got to one up chronic illness. There's only so
many. And it's a three word title.
So. Okay. Yeah, love it. Love it.
So I think that was attractive to me. And getting back to the very top of this conversation, black metal lyricism, when it's not concerned with the metaphysics, it is very bleak, right? You know, as you know, there's a certain subgenre of black metal, depressive, suicidal black, you know. So there's that tradition there. And I think this is in line with that, which is like nutritionally eating dirt, you're poisoning yourself,
sure,
you know. And God, this is probably saying too much, but also this idea came up in therapy too, which is I would have dreams of this too. And the idea of being in the woods and choosing to be there alone and surviving only on dirt, and my therapist, you know, pointing out that these are fantasies and dreams about having an emptiness, right? Mm-hmm. That is only satisfied by not even the minimum of what satisfies that, but in shape and form it is. Like it's a thing that you can almost chew and you could almost metabolize it, but you can't, and it actually poisons you, and you could pass from that.
It also just sounds like witchy shit. It's very like divine and or monstrous feminine image.
There's a blurry line between it and like putting two hands on a tree and closing your eyes or something.
Sure.
Yeah.
The last of the questions I sent you was, what's your coma? And
yeah,
I think I explained the metaphorical nature of this question. I will explain the origin of it, which is that I was in a coma like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of the work has come from that and been spiced with coma, but I'm more interested in any moment, big or small, where you can look back and say, oh, this was one version of me, that was another. What's one of yours?
The reaction you're getting from me now is knowing that you can guess what I'm struggling with right now, which is resisting the idea that there wasn't a profound before and after thing coming out, you know?
As trans.
Yeah. Like, I'm trying really hard to not be that predictable.
Well, of course that's it. Do you want to keep going, or should I vamp a little bit in response to what you just said?
Let me keep going.
Yeah.
Because I think I have a take on this that is not well represented. I've posted about this once or twice, but it's simply the idea that resists in a very personal way the idea that trans is beautiful. And that, I mean, it is, obviously, but like, there's this idea that once you live authentically or something, you are then given license or a blank check to live fully. And what living fully means is bringing your full self to your job and bringing your full self to your relationship dynamics and having this like tingly feeling in your heart when you go to Starbucks and they say, what's your name? And you say Alexis rather than Alex or something. Mm-hmm. That package of ideas has not been true for me. Coming out to me has been a before and after thing as a sort of negative image. And it's, I'm not exactly saying it is not just a bizarro image or like a funhouse image of the Molly rolling down the hill thing, but I'm also not saying that. It's easy, and I'm being so reductive here, and I mean most of this, but not all of it with my soul. I'm being, you know, but it's easy on a timeline, from like a timeline POV, to be like, okay, here's when this happened, and here's when coming out happened. How have things been since then? How have they really been? Mm-hmm. In a net way, net positive, net negative way? And I don't like the answer. And what the sort of logical fallacy that I'm doing is I'm saying coming out is such a profound thing to do that it is so profound that you can measure your whole life in a before and after snapshot in terms of quality. And I know that I'm committing that logical fallacy, which is why I'm saying I don't really mean all of this in a real way. But it's easy for me to have this heuristic of like, well, let's think about what's happened since I came out. I have lost connection with family, like immediate family. My dating life sucks. And I could talk more about that.
If you want to, sure.
Sure.
Let's go. But, let's become a dating podcast rather than an afterlife podcast.
Yeah. There's a lot to say there. But like, I know that I've been passed over on certain like high, like these kind of prestigious like tech jobs while I was like an egg, what we call an egg, right? I know it.
An egg being like a baby trans or?
You're nailing it, yeah.
Okay.
Community kind of, like, there's just so many ways to measure an after coming out that when compared before is bleak. And of course it's bleak. Like, I was a white guy, like, of anything in comparison you know, there's this whole thing is laden with logical fallacies. I understand. Mm-hmm. I'm just getting off my chest a lot of things. So this is the coma. I could talk about dating if you want, however you want to take this. That's the coma metaphor for me.
Well, the reason I ask this question and the reason I haven't stopped finding this question interesting is because I really resist easy narrativization of my life and prone to it as well.
Yeah. But
you know, so for me, the coma is one metaphorical coma, sobriety, which happened right around that same time as a result of it, is another probably more important one. But it was early sobriety that I got on Facebook and had a fight and weaponized my coma and told someone that I actually, because I was like eulogized on Facebook as part of the coma. And like these people, I was picking a fight with this improv teacher and all of his buddies came in to the comments and they were all just all these guys were in the past tense because I want to say people can change, but I'm not hopeful, but they were just pieces of shit. And I was just going after all of them, talking about what like creeps they were. And one of these guys said like, one of them called me a cancer to every room I enter, which was like,
what?
It was and that particular guy was a real like takes one to know one sort of situation.
Yeah.
But then I weaponized my own. I was like, actually, I have like hundreds of eulogies that say the opposite, you know? And then another one of the guys said to me, and I give so much credit for the best takedown I have ever had myself or heard anyone else having, because he said it must kill you that you weren't alive for the 2 weeks that people had nice things to say about you. Right. And that was in, which is, I mean, truly like an incredible burn. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
like
yeah.
Impressive, but
devastating. Yeah.
Yeah. But that happened 3 months sober. You know what I mean? That's not a thing that's supposed to happen in sobriety, you know?
That's a
before moment that happens in the after of the narrative, you know? And so I, of course, as someone who, I can say even without knowing you well, like, cares about you and cares about the art you make.
Likewise.
And, like, and yeah, is like invested in you not seeing everything in the net, you know, as a net positive or net negative. But it makes total sense to me, this impulse to do that. And it also, it's tough to talk about this stuff too, because it's like when I first got sober, you show up to these rooms. Some of them, the traditions are weird, the cultures are weird, the rituals are weird.
A lot of cigarettes.
Like, cigarettes. You're like, you're angry because all your coping mechanisms are gone. So yeah. I'm like pointing that at people in the room. I'm being like, this meeting sucks. And I'm like sharing at the meeting this stuff.
Yeah.
And people are just smiling. And at the end of the meeting, they're like, keep coming back, man. You're in the right place. Because they can all relate to that. And to me, and this relates to black metal, and what I have come to really enjoy about black metal is the important thing was that I had my butt in the seat as I was making those complaints. So I think what you're saying would hit a lot different if you had not come out. The fact that you came out, like, speaks to the necessity, the taken for granted beauty of transness that you mentioned is like, I do believe that you genuinely believe that being trans is beautiful.
Of course,
and like
of course.
And,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But I also, I started to get obsessed with black metal in the fall because I was feeling so much. I wish there were a less cliche word, but it was toxic positivity that I was feeling, of just like everything was being spun as like, oh, you know, even like hard things were like, or people trying to make difficult works of art, they like resolved themselves very easily. And I was like, the thing I like about this music is that it says things are bad and there's no period. It just it just trails off, or it smashes into the next song and it washes over me. And there is something so affirming in that expression.
That's real. And sorry, just to follow up, was the toxic positivity for you coming from sobriety is beautiful, you are beautiful, or was it another part of your life?
Totally different stuff.
Okay.
Just like, you know, being in little art communities and hearing, honestly, it comes from like judging other people's ideas for their own projects a little bit, which is like, I'm aware is more about me than it is about them. But like, you know, also politically, people wanting a way out of things, you know?
Yeah.
If I could, as an analog to the trans thing, I think my reaction to being like, oh, it's actually not all that great or whatever, is the misrepresentation of trans people online. I think that it's hard to talk about this stuff without acknowledging that there is just such that the messaging online, and this has changed in the last few months, of course.
Sure.
The messaging online is that, like, once you transition, equal sign, your life is better. And I'm just here to be a gadfly to that idea, because it's not true. It wasn't true for me. It's not true for so many people. But I think for clicks or whatever, I think there's a racket of toxic positivity encouraging people maybe to explore it. Because on the other side of it is happiness. And that might be true in 40 years, but at least in the first 10 or whatever,
right?
It ain't it's not that simple.
Well, and it's hard because, I mean, the nature of a mouth is that only one word can come out of it at a time. The nature of...
Damn, Dave, that's good.
The nature
I
of
mean
a,
it. I mean
of
it.
A, no, I appreciate it. But the nature of a post is that, like, you can only post one... There's only... We all hate that it's reductive and that nuance is lost. And yet...
Yes, I'm not saying anything new here. Yes,
but no. I'm not saying... I'm not even...
But still.
Yeah. But, like, the... Because some of those messages are necessary for, like, kids who
some
are struggling.
Are
like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Some people, depending on where they're at in the process, need different things affirmed. I'm needing some negativity affirmed. It sounds like you're needing some negativity affirmed,
yeah.
Or at least willing to affirm other people's negativity. A lot of people, I think, have a simpler relationship with affirmation, where it's like they need...
Yeah,
they need hope, and hope comes with, like, good news, as opposed to, like, we're all in this together, even if this is a sinking ship.
I'm going to be thinking about this. Yeah. Yeah. Hopium is my dope. I got nothing. Sorry. Not enough coffee.
Ugh. Well, the show's supposed to end with you dropping the mic, not me dropping the mic. So I feel as if I failed you. You've made me look very good here at the end, but
okay,
yeah,
that's all I'm concerned about. That's my only thing I wanted to do today.
Well, no, but I want to make you look good.
Were we going to talk about dating? I feel like we were.
Okay, talk
we're
about
probably
dating.
Time.
No, where there's no time.
Okay.
Time is in a little bit when my partner shifted the library ends. So that's
okay. But that's a little bit.
That's over an hour away. So,
and it might not have been dating, but I felt like there's an avenue of development for something we were talking about.
At
I don't
least.
Know. But I'll just do that.
Why is dating hard?
So I didn't know this about you. You have a partner?
Yeah.
Okay. How long have you been together?
10 years, 10 and a half.
That's amazing.
Almost 11, actually. Yeah.
That rocks. Congratulations. I love that mug.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a, you know, and having a partner, you know, solves everything, and life is really easy once you're, you know, that's it. It's all taken care of. No maintenance necessary, and yeah.
No copium here. I mean, that's truce. No, you're right. I mean, it's not. Yeah, it doesn't solve everything. I think my frustration, and I've been feeling this a lot lately, is I've been thinking about it numerically, which is a big mistake.
Yeah.
It's a big mistake because that is step zero in a pipeline of getting onto some, like, grifter shit or some, like, incel shit, which is this. I'm interested. I'm not strictly... gay, but let's say for this exercise I am. So that's out of 100% of the people on earth, that's already, we're lopping off half of that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's gone. And then you know, it gets worse from there, which is, okay, what part of that 50% are women who are not even just gay, let's round it up, who are queer? I don't know. 12? I really don't know.
Yeah.
Out of that 12%, I'm cursed. I have a type physically.
Okay.
And like everything else too, but physically.
Is there a famous avatar of this type?
Oh yeah, probably.
Or just the general sketch of it. And you don't have to reveal more than you're comfortable with, but
oh no.
I mean, this kind of shit.
I'm here for it all.
Okay. Let's go.
I'm trying to think of like a celebrity that is not super predictable. I mean, I think Charlie XCX is like one of the most beautiful people in the world.
Okay.
Just like, you know, brown hair, brown eyes, a lot to, you know, that kind of like, I just really am into that.
Okay.
It's not uncommon. There are a lot of people like that, but
of course.
Anyways, so out of that 12%, how many of them match that? 7. I don't know. I'm being generous, but 7.
Yeah.
Out of those people, now we're into like the psychological type
yeah.
that I'm into that we all have. Maybe not. Maybe we don't all have that. But my values or whatever, what I'm looking for is, you know, someone who could do bits, number one,
yeah,
with a bullet.
Uh-huh.
Someone who's funny, who's like overeducated. Hell, gainfully employed.
Oof.
Can we have it all? I don't know. And so how many of that 7% is that?
Yeah.
Two? And I live in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Pittsburgh's not fucking the lake, though. Pittsburgh is cool.
Mutually exclusive, I think. I like Pittsburgh a lot. Pittsburgh is cool. Does Pittsburgh have a queer scene that includes people I'm interested in whose, again, primary performance characteristic isn't watching One Punch Man? No,
oh,
not really.
Oh, boy. Oh, man. That's like two.
Yeah, yeah.
So
anyways, this is just me. I don't have... I'm just complaining.
There's a specific, like... There's a generational connection, I feel, as you're talking to, where I'm just like... It sounds like you maybe had some of the anime stuff miss you. And, like, I've tried to really, I had heard black metal years ago and was like, this shit sucks. It sounds awful. Why does anyone want to listen to it? And I love being surprised by art.
Yeah.
Maybe someday that happens for me with anime, but there's a lot of walls to that happening. And it sounds like you maybe have some of the same walls.
We are cellmates, except we're not in the same cell. We share a wall. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. It is a generational thing. I think, like, I was a Pokemon kid, and that's as close as I got.
See, I was not. And I remember at stand-up open mics when people started doing Pokemon jokes, and I was like, what the fuck is happening?
So...
This
isolating.
Is so unrelatable and weird, and you sound like you're in sixth grade. And now I realize that shit was changing and I was the weird one. You know what I mean?
Feels bad, man.
Feels bad, man.
What was the gateway of black metal for you?
Why am I forgetting? Black Metal Rainbows. That's the name of the book, right?
Oh, yeah. Cool. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was the book. I was at the socialism conference last year. They have a bookstore at the conference. The cover of the ballerina with the corpse paint and the shiny silver cover.
It's evocative. Yeah.
Was fucking awesome.
Yeah.
As a bit of a little mischief maker contrarian, I was having fun showing people the cover and being like, isn't this cool, this book I got?
Yeah.
And then I was reading it and I was like, this is fucking awesome. You know, as someone who's gotten like more and more radical in my politics and then at a certain point I realized I was enjoying reading about this music more than I had ever enjoyed listening to it. And I was like, at the very least, I gotta try. I gotta understand like where things are coming from. So I was like, I can't just like be able to like talk to people about the finer points of the fucking Dark Throne discography without like knowing a little bit about what I'm talking about. And honestly, the sort of like, I hope it doesn't feel reductive, but the like Bandcamp strain of black metal is kind of where I found stuff that I like the most. So
that's real. I think this is anecdotal.
And I knew I liked the one Pink Def Heaven record. I was like, I remember liking this. This can...
You were an egg. That was your egg moment.
Yeah.
I thought you were an egg, Dave.
Good for me to appropriate trans culture in that way. No, I think that's a good look for me. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I give you you're invited to the trans barbecue for sure.
That's always good too. I have some of my best friends... so that's why. But what was your approach, like first exposure?
Yeah. I talk about this a lot because when I talk about my banned to civilians, by which I mean non like workmates or someone, and it's, yeah. and someone, they're not a metal fan or something. I'm at a bar or something, and they're like, "Well, oh, you play music? Like, what kind of music do you play?" I do frame it like if I was an adult and someone played me black metal or death metal or any type of extreme metal, I'd be like, "Please turn this off, mm-hmm. please, please, please." Mm-hmm. So if I didn't have this happened to me, then I would be one of those people, maybe, who knows. But I had a guitar teacher at a young age. I was taking classical lessons from him. I knew he played in a metal band. I played in a punk band at the time. Mm. I was like, "What kind of metal do you make?" And he was kind enough. His name is Aaron. He plays in a band called Nechachwa now. To burn me some CDRs of Pestilence, Atheist, Catatonia, I think Bloodbath was in there, or what's the Michael Ochterfeldt death metal thing?
I'm still too new to.
Oh, okay, sorry.
No.
But Opeth was part of that too.
Okay.
And Cynic, and the Human Record by Death, which if you don't know, Dave, please look up Human by Death. So if I didn't have that, that mentor kind of like
yeah.
person be like, "Here you go." I don't know if I would have ever arrived to it. And I think a lot of people hear the vocals of this kind of metal and they're laughable to them. And I think that phrase is used kind of commonly, like the cookie monster, but like it's easy to make fun of and it's easy to be like, "What are they so mad at?"
But it's also kind of like, why aren't you
look around,
more mad,
sir?
Yeah.
And you are a sir. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, no, he is.
that was my gateway, I guess. I went from like a huge Dream Theater fan to like a huge Death fan.
Okay. Is that your answer when people ask about what music you make? You like give them your way into it as like a way for them to understand what you would enjoy about it?
I think so, and I think I also do that because it gives them an off-ramp to maybe hearing my band and not feeling like they have to say, interesting sounds you make, which, like, we all know what that means.
Yeah.
So, like, it's completely okay. This
it
stuff
sounds
is not
like you're
for
really
everyone.
Having fun up there. You
know? Yeah. I really like that sheer top.
Yeah.
It's really not
Where
for everyone.
Where did you get that guitar?
Six strings on that thing, right?
Yeah. That is, I mean, do you clench your teeth before answering that question?
Yeah.
Or have you gotten better at it where you're just like, "Oh, I just rattle off my answer," because
it's rote. Yeah.
Okay. It's both.
Yeah. It's not for everyone. It's not designed to be for everyone. If I can do a callback to like the dating thing, like this sounds so dramatic, but I'm going to say it.
Yeah.
It sometimes feels like when you're into a very specific thing that you are punished for being into very specific things or having very specific needs. You know, I think people with like extreme like kinks probably feel this a lot, which is like I'm into this very, very, very specific thing. It's a price of admission for me in a relationship. And it sucks that I have this because it rules out, you know, if I'm at an unlucky 3%, they're at like an unlucky 0.2, depending on what it is. And I think the same's true for music too, which is like, I like a very, very specific thing, but I'm also realistic that like its specificity means that it's to the exclusion of like so much other stuff. We can connect on other music really easily. Let's talk about that. I'm seeing Not a Surf tomorrow. They're like my favorite band. So like I'm happy to connect on other stuff, but you get a free pass for not being in the metal. It's not for everyone.
Are you keeping up with Not a Surf?
Oh yeah. Their most recent stuff is their best stuff.
Really?
Some of it. Yeah.
That Let Go record meant a lot.
Oh,
Let
Go is it's the best. Yeah.
I drank Killian's Red because of
whoa
that song, you know, like
what you say. Hey, I almost, if they don't play that tomorrow, I'm gonna be bummed. But yeah, what a great track, what a great record. Yeah,
Yeah, I mean, that. Well, okay, also, another thing that I, because I was also thinking about a thing I'd seen you, at least maybe it was in the City Paper article that you did, the Pittsburgh City Paper article, where you were talking about being a funny person, but not, but your music not being funny.
Yeah.
Well, has your feeling about that changed?
No, it's a stock line for me because it'll always be true. Like we just wrapped up like a European tour, and sometimes, you know, between songs, I'll respond to something, and it gets from the crowd. Someone from the crowd says, "I respond." I do like a micro crowd work or something,
right?
And it gets a laugh. But I like the stock line is like, "I'm silly. My music's not silly, but like I sometimes am, and like it's that's okay."
Can I rebut the music not being?
Oh yeah, yeah. Please.
There's like a doo-wop harmony on one of the songs, and I'm forgetting it now. But there's it's a little like doo-wop, doo-doo-wop. Like you're not saying the words doo-wop, but in the middle of a black metal song, that shit is funny as fuck.
Oh, cool.
Like, that's like funny in the, let me be really pretentious now, sort of like G.K. Chesterton describing Sunday and the man who was Thursday is like the god stand-in. And he's so, his humor is so, like, expansive that he doesn't even laugh at jokes. He laughs at like the existence of things. And that's the humor of those moments in the music, is that it's like, it's not like a ha ha funny. It's like a, if I can name drop a little bit, when I interviewed Low, I talked to them about that song, That's How You Sing Amazing Grace.
Yeah.
And how, if you deliver that line just a little bit different, as if you're like putting someone in their place, as if like they just sang Amazing Grace and then you sang it and you're letting them know that's how you sing Amazing Grace, is like really funny. Like that's like a really funny line. And that's the kind of funny in music that I fucking love.
This is what we call a rich text.
Exactly.
Yeah. And as a callback, a little bit of the Sin City thing.
Yes.
To be honest.
I mean, intent on making Sin City work. And I can't tell if I'm on board or if
I can't either. borrowing across different genres is and having them clash or maybe harmonize is fun. Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right about that.
We'll end on a music thing, which is just another callback that the coverer of Anthems for a 17-Year-Old Girl on the TV Glow soundtrack is Yule, Y-E-U-L-E. I think she is the correct pronoun, had a like crunchy post-Grimes best new music on Pitchfork in the last couple of years.
You'll probably remember that for a long time.
Yeah. I hear Yule and I think of Soulja Boy.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
See, our non-anime pasts are really coming
isn't
out.
Yeah, all these other people watching their fucking anime, there's a world out there of fucking Soulja Boy songs and Juliana Theory. You know,
goddamn
I mean?
Right. Do you know what Soulja Boying a hoe is? I found this out somewhat recently.
Is it the jizz on the sheet and the back, the jizz on the back, and you stick a sheet to the jizz?
So that when she gets out of bed, she has a cape on.
Right.
Yes. Superman. Pretty good. Can we end there?
We can, especially because I don't know if you can hear, my cat is doing his like howling thing in the back.
I can hear a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, he's like, you're at the Superman thing, where you're done with the podcast.
That's time.
That's the show. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Aaron, for being on this show, for trusting me with the time it took to put this episode out. Please listen to her music. That Chronic Illness Wish record is so good. The links to explore that are in the show description. Thank you to Matt Sage for the show's art. And This Is Your Afterlife house band Lake Mary for the show's music. Visit patreon.com/thisisyourafterlife to support the show and get the premium feed. Follow the show at This Is Your Afterlife on Instagram. Go to thisisyourafterlife.com for more info. And you can email thoughts, questions, and preemptive eulogies to thisisyourafterlifepodcast@gmail.com. That is what I've got. Very happy to be back. Thank you for being here. Until next time, which, if you are only on the main feed here, is in 2 weeks. If you're listening via Patreon, I'll talk to you next week. But until then, remember, you are a mist.